From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The provocation posed by DPRK is our top priority because there is still further potential of further provocations brought by North Korea.
That was Yun Byung-sae, Foreign Minister of the Republic of Korea, or South Korea, at a joint press conference in Seoul with U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson Friday.
And we also have the killing of Kim Jong-un, and they may also use the chemical weapons. So we have to carefully think about the policies.
Tillerson said the policy of strategic patience has ended. He added that although U.S. military action against the DPRK was an option on the table, Pyongyang need not fear an invasion.
Both the ROK and the United States have been quite clear over these 20 years that we seek nothing but a stable Korean peninsula and an economically prosperous Korean peninsula. North Korea has nothing to fear from the United States.
But the latest ramping up of hostilities comes as South Korea is itself in a political crisis, with the removal of the president last Friday by the country's constitutional court, which unanimously upheld a parliamentary vote to impeach her for her role in a corruption and influence peddling scandal. That came in the midst of massive street protests against her hard line against labor. Tillerson urged China to refrain from creating economic sanctions that could hinder South Korea's deployment of a U.S. Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, anti-ballistic missile system. Seoul and Washington first agreed to deploy THAAD in July of last year. The deployment prompted strong criticism from Beijing, which enacted economic policies in protest. China's retaliation resulted in the temporary suspension of tour package sales to South Koreans. Similarly, China has reportedly boycotted some South Korean products, including those of the Lot Group, the conglomerate which sold one of its golf courses to the South Korean government for the THAAD system. The U.S. Secretary of State is set to visit Beijing next. For more on all that, we spoke with our regular political commentator, Professor Tony Montero, via Skype from Philadelphia Friday.
There's a lot to untangle here. First of all, this is the first major foreign policy move of a government that is in deep, almost irreversible crisis. And I would just say, I'm of the opinion now that that Trump will not be able to govern. They have literally eviscerated him. He is surrounded by people who do not agree with him on much of anything. And then he has a very hostile Republican majority in the House and in the Senate. So he is on an island. Now, of course, he remains popular among the people who voted for him, but short of a major uprising, I don't think he will be able to govern. Therefore, people like Tillerson will govern in his name. And this is a manufactured crisis. It's a crisis that doesn't have to be, and it is a crisis manufactured by what we now call the deep state, and its objective is not North Korea, but its objective is to test the Trump administration and to test how Trump himself will respond to such a manufactured crisis. However, that is not to in any way minimize the great danger posed here. The placing of these THAAD missiles in South Korea, which are only one part of a larger nuclear enterprise on the Korean Peninsula and in Northeast Asia. China has appropriately responded by imposing sanctions upon South Korea. and has expressed in no uncertain terms its displeasure with what the United States is doing. In fact, for many years, has called upon South Korea and the United States to pull back from these annual exercises, which have become increasingly aggressive because now, since the mid-90s, they have involved strategic nuclear bombers and warships that are armed with nuclear weapons. And now, in the last couple of years, they have brought Japan into this, yeah, which cannot make any Korean or Chinese at all happy with what is going on.
Yeah. So, before we go anywhere, let me get to a couple. No, because I want to contextualize this for people a little bit. In the 1990s, we're talking about in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. figured that North Korea and Cuba could be tipped over. And so they intensified sanctions against both countries, imposing incredible hardships on both countries. The people in each country were almost starving. And that was when the Clinton administration introduced nuclear weapons to into these tests, you know, these drills on the Korean Peninsula. That's the context. And I just also wanted to posit the possibility that Tillerson is actually there representing Trump and not the deep state, or is making up his mind as he feels the tugs on the leash from either direction. And because it's worth speculating if he's there representing Trump, what the game might be. And then, of course, we know what the deep state's game is because it's being played out.
Yeah, I think that I think there are threats. But I don't know how much that Tillerson is making, but I don't know how much he has to back those threats up. You know, and as you mentioned, there is no permanent South Korean government. There's an acting president, and there are elections to be held, I think, in May or June in South Korea. As you know, one of the candidates, and I think the one who in the polls is in the lead right now, wants to reverse the policies of the last few Korean governments and return to what they call the sunshine policy of cooperation and detente between North and South Korea. And of course, I'm certain that the Chinese government would encourage such a move. So Japan and whoever Tillerson represents are on the verge of being isolated. And again, I'd like to emphasize that the American people are tired of these wars. That's right. Part of the reason Trump won.
Right.
The exhaustion of these wars and people feeling that they had been lied to about these wars and the trillions of dollars alone in the Middle East wars that have depleted the U.S. Budget. And in part is responsible for this unbelievable and historic debt that the federal government finds itself in.
Yeah.
So who is Tillerson speaking for? Certainly he's not speaking for the Trump constituency, nor for the American public broadly conceived.
Yeah, well, we might see that. I mean, that's going to play out in Beijing at the end of the day.
Definitely.
And you mentioned that you have all these, you have that the same currents. I mean, Tillerson is kind of in the middle of currents. You have Trump presumably seeking, calmer and more normalized relations with China and a focus on business and economic issues, who again, as we mentioned earlier, and I think in the last discussion we had, that he gifted China, a few tens or hundreds of billions of dollars by killing the TPP. You have that trend in the U.S. and the deep state trend that is, playing aggressive against Russia and China. You have the trend inside the Republic, inside South Korea, also looking to reduce tensions. You have Beijing looking to reduce tensions. And then you have Tillerson sort of getting pulled every which way, and also the elite in South Korea. And there's also a strong street presence in Japan against this stuff, too.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, let's not forget, Tillerson is the Secretary of State, not the Secretary of War.
Right.
I mean, what is he doing threatening military action? He's the Secretary of State, allegedly the top diplomat. He's supposed to explore diplomatic solutions to tensions and disagreements. Now, for him to go out as he has suggest that, well, but you know, let me just say this. It's clear that for some years now, maybe 15 years, the State Department has ceased to be a center of diplomacy. And of course, with Hillary Clinton, it became a instrument of war and threat and belligerency.
Yeah, I mean, we had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was made Secretary of State back in the Bush administration, for example.
Absolutely.
Pretty clear
signal. That too. And often you find the Secretary of State being more hawkish than even the Secretary of Defense. And it's so interesting that the Secretary of Defense in the latter part of the Obama administration, Ash Carter, reasserts the military kind of thrust of the Defense Department. But I'm of the opinion, this is why I think, we're looking at the deep state assert itself in and through the Trump administration. I think that really, and it's disappointing in certain ways, given, the stuff on the TPP and his opposition to regime change in Russia and all that type of thing, that now he's been overtaken. And I don't believe that he politically can recapture the moment. Now, the good news, of course, is that the United States is in a crisis. The deep state is being attacked by Trump himself. The deep state is split. And by that, I mean the CIA, the think tanks, the military forces. They're not united. But then, of course, the nation that the United States claims to be defending, South Korea, might vote in the next few months when they have a presidential election against being protected by the United States and viewing their defense as something they should be responsible for, and believing that their defense cannot come from the United States and certainly not Japan, and will be based upon a sunshine policy with North Korea and a real detente and cooperation with China, upon whom they are very dependent economically.
So Trump, meanwhile, is not without tools in this either. China is the largest trading partner and creditor of the United States. I would guess one of the repositories of a lot of capital of American mm-hmm. corporations.
Right.
It is the chief rival on the stage, economically, on the global mm-hmm. stage. Again, China was handed a gift by the Trump administration and by the working class of the United mm-hmm. States, really,
right.
with the dismantling of TPP. Mm-hmm. And if Tillerson, after thumping his chest in Tokyo and Seoul, ends up in Beijing and cuts a real politic deal with China, that would boost Trump considerably and provide some material basis, perhaps, depending on what China throws into the pot. That would be, translated into political capital for both Trump and a trend towards normalizing relations with the other great powers.
Yeah, well, you can rest assured that Tillerson is going to have a different tone when he goes to Beijing, because it's not South Korea. Their leadership is not in crisis. So he's going to talk different. And the Chinese, according to what we read in their press and statements from their leadership, are not going to tolerate a lot of belligerency and big willy talk coming from the United States. It's just not that time of day. you know, things have substantially changed in the world, politically and financially and economically, since the financial collapse of 2008-2009. It's a different world. And, of course, part of the different world is the restiveness of the working people in the advanced capitalist countries, including the United States, which is causing tremendous instability throughout Europe and the United States. And that is a factor of great significance in how nations are governed and how they pursue, especially the imperialist nations, how they pursue their foreign policy objectives.
You know, that even affects South Korea. I'm looking at a report CNBC reports. Trump's aggressive. He's imputing it to Trump. But the aggressive North Korea stance may face a backlash in Seoul. Mm-hmm. So, and you've said that the Korean people are in the streets. And there is also the South Korean elite. You know, China and South Korea have very close economic ties that have developed over the last decade. And, there are some folks who are very powerful in South Korea making a lot of money with China.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you know, it's not just Northeast Asia, but the whole Asian sphere is undergoing some important changes. And, you know, we just need to point to the Philippines. As one key place, and I think the elections in Korea. And I think it's worth reminding people that the former president was brought down not only because of corruption. That was only a small part of it. I think the largest part was the fact that she represented capitalist elements within the South Korean economy that wanted to reform the labor laws, which meant reducing the rights to organize and so on of workers, which had led to just a series of general strikes over the last couple of years. And so that government was unpopular, not only because of corruption, but I think mainly because of its attacks upon the labor movement, the middle class, the standard of living of people, and so on. And therefore, the next president will have to be mindful, and can only win, I would say, if he runs on a platform that is pro-working people, pro-peace, pro-detente with the North Koreans, and cooperation with China. And of course, no military cooperation with Japan. Never. Never can the Koreans or the Chinese, North or South, accept Korea occupying, Japan occupying Korea.
Yeah, I mean, we have to go back only 72 years remember.
And to understand that, yes, yes. And, you know, just one other thing, you know, the myth that South Korea is threatened by the North. And I'm certain if they can ratchet up tensions, then they're going to bring China in. China is a threat to South Korea. I mean, that's the way the deep state and its think tanks operate in the United States to create a fictional narrative. But, you know, Don, if I could just go back to something that we talked about before, because this relates to how the left and progressive forces in the United States act in this moment. A lot of people were saying that in November 8th, we elected a neo-fascist, that this was the worst of all possible outcomes, and therefore it would have been better, even though many don't say it. They say a condemnation on both of your houses. But in the end, they're actually saying that it would have been better to have a Hillary Clinton presidency. You and I have disagreed with that over the months. I mean, passionately and deeply disagreed. And I think it's worth saying again, the worst of all possible outcomes on November 8th would have been the election of Hillary Clinton. We don't have to go into that. But the other thing is, in a conversation we had about a week or so ago, I made the assertion that in the United States, and I want to qualify it, in the United States, fascists do not have to run for election.
Right.
Because they are embedded in the deep state. If you want to find the fascists, go to the deep state. You don't get more fascists, if you want to use that word, than Victoria Nuland. You don't get more fascists than Robert Kagan or Negroponte or a whole number of them whose names, you know, we know and don't know. The deep state is synonymous with all of the evil and all of the corruption, all of the mass murders and deaths that we associate with the United States. So we did not elect a neo-fascist. The neo-fascists were already present, were operating in the Obama administrations, the Bush administration, and probably for the last 25 years. And they have found that that democracy is but a veil. It's but a fiction. Let the people vote. It makes no difference. Those who run the country are going to remain in power no matter what. You know, be they in these think tanks, be they embedded in the State Department, the Pentagon, the Federal Reserve, or on Wall Street. They are there for the long run. They have strategic visions. It makes no difference who the president is. They will govern. So I think going forward, how do we fight for peace? That was the question you asked before. What do we do? What is to be done in the face of a still aggressive and predatory American imperialism? And I said then, and I think it's still true, go to the people who voted against war. Go to the people who polls show are in opposition to militarism and war and want something done about the economic problems here in the United States. That's where you go to build a peace movement. Don't go to the college professors and the upper middle class. They don't understand this and they don't have a deep stake in it. The other thing is, if the left wishes to situate itself as a force for peace, and here I am talking about the left broadly conceived as the liberal or progressive left, and more narrowly conceived as the so-called revolutionary left. If they want to be a force for peace, an agency for peace, I think first and foremost, they must separate themselves from the party of war. And that is not just the Democrats, but mainly the Democratic leadership at this time. But also, they must consider how their politics, how their rhetoric, how their actions situate them objectively in an alliance with the deep state. The anti-Trump movement is, in essence, a movement generated by the deep state whose purpose, whose objective, as they say, is to bring about the removal of Trump either through a coup d'etat, an impeachment, assassination, to cite David Brooks of the New York Times. So, I mean, it's not rocket science. It's just basic politics.
Yeah.
How close do you have to be to the deep state before you realize that you are, at the end of the day, but an instrument of their larger strategic goal to retake the government of the United States as a part of its strategic objectives on a world scale?
Yeah. I mean, objectively speaking, here's what we have. Despite the fact that Trump had promised better relations with Russia and an end to regime change and such, and that people responded to it, we saw them in Cleveland do that. They went to their feet, Republicans.
Yeah.
He got elected saying all that stuff while he was being attacked for being a stooge of Russia.
Yeah.
We have seen instead, since his administration took office, a continuation of the operation of drills along Russia's border. Now the installation of THAAD missiles, and in Bulgaria, where they had installed anti-missile systems, we had actual troop movements again over the past few days. Mm-hmm. So that is either Trump fooled us, or Trump is being, you know, caged by the deep state, and it's operating regardless of what policy is. You know, if the left is going to parse this stuff and try to understand what's happening, certainly as they accuse Trump still of being a Russian stooge and continue their aggressive posture towards Russia, which the installation of a THAAD also is, because North Korea borders Russia as well as China. And so you're talking about a missile defense, quote unquote, on the east flank. You know, the anti-war movement has to take a look at who's on which side in that fight. And it's a fight playing out in front of everybody.
Yes, yes. And you know, I think the political crisis in this country is not going away anytime soon. We are not in normal times. You know, that is why I think the rhetoric and analysis of some on the left that about Republicans and Democrats, it's not about that at all. It's about the people versus the deep state. These parties are fractured. You know, is Trump a Republican? That's a big question. Most Republicans would say no. He's an opportunist. He used the opportunity to seize government power by taking the Republican nomination by an already broken political vehicle. He realized that somehow. But now the Democrats are broken. I mean, Bernie Sanders is running around trying to, in a certain sense, play Trump, you know, by going to the working people in West Virginia and in Michigan and other places, and saying to them, in effect, that the Democratic Party is not the party of the working people. And if the Democrats are to ever regain the political initiative, and not just at the presidency, but the Congress and the Senate and state houses and governorships and so on, it must recraft its message. And it must have a message that speaks to the needs of working people. Well, that doesn't sound to me like a Democratic Party that's united. It sounds like, to me, a Democratic Party that is at war with itself and about ready to break apart, just like the Republicans. Some people would argue that the Trump presidency is the beginning of the reversal of the imperial presidency that we began to see with Nixon and forward, a reduced presidency. Now, that might be a forced march where we have forces in the Congress, Republicans in the Congress and Senate, people like McCain and Ryan and Lindsey Graham, who will attempt to seize power over a presidency that is isolated and under attack. And I just like to just end on this. I mean, CNN did a so-called documentary last Monday for Fareed Zakaria. And what this so-called on Putin, but what it said it, that Trump is a puppet of Putin, that literally the presidency of the United States is an extension of the presidency of Russia. This is talk the likes of which we have never heard, even in the Cold War. But it is a manifestation, I think, of the depth of the political crisis. It is the deep state and its agents within the corporate media fighting back to regain absolute power and to assert the authority of the deep state over the institutions of government.
Professor Montero, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.